Hallo, ja. Okay, so continue now. I went a couple of minutes too far in the previous lecture, so I will repeat briefly these slides. So it shows the classification of resilience types, and as you can see, there are on the left column, resilience internal in the critical infrastructure and those of society, which comes into play because society has the organization for dealing with major events, political, first responder units like firefighters, police, medical equipment, and so on. And then the government. And the region and so on has systems for organizing resilience. Funding is needed, and people typically need also to be involved so as to deal with the situation, with the risk, and so on. Can be both preparing them for the unexpected, but also volunteers and so on and so on. So, internal and external resilience, and within each of them, there are different dimensions like. Related to technology, organization, economic, and social resilience. That is, social resilience is not part of the internal. And then for each of these, policies are identified that are needed to achieve resilience. How were they identified, these policies? Partly from the literature, but also by a process which is known as a Delphi process. The Delphi process, you produce surveys where you involve experts. So, in this research, experts in resilience from different countries were asked to review some proposal that the PhD student had developed and to comment on that. And based on these comments and discussions in the Delphi, a new version was produced, which was again reviewed and so on, and that led in the end to such a structure. In addition to defining this structure that you see here, and you can see among the resilience policies how they pertain. So, for instance, to achieve technical resilience in the CI and the critical infrastructure, you have to think of how to design and construct the critical infrastructure with safety in mind. How to maintain that, and so on, and so on. How to monitor, and so on. Organization resilience, which procedures you need for crisis management, how to commit top management, and so on, and so on. For economic resilience, prepare with a crisis response budget. In external resilience, about society, you need to have some equipment for external crisis response equipment that will be in the first responders, firefighters, and so on. Organization resilience, preparing the responders, prepare the government, have a network community, and so on. Economic resilience, public crisis response budget. Social resilience, creating societal situation awareness, and so that if something big happens, then the community can. Know what to do or can quickly be informed as to what to do. Then it's obvious that policies are not completely independent. Some of them are based on prior steps. So, how do you determine the order of implementation? Again, what Labaca did was to involve develop proposals that were then validated with experts so as to determine the temporal order of implementation. And here you see, for instance, for technical resilience, first is design and construction, first stage. Maintenance comes later. Plans for that. Acquisition and monitoring systems later, and so on. And similarly for the others, you see when the experts agree that the policies should come into play, considering five different stages. So this development was based again on literature studies, proposals that were then submitted to experts, response from the experts using Delphi exercises. So the overall conclusion is that this research intended to present a framework for developing resilience in critical infrastructure. It considered not only the staff and the resources in its critical infrastructure, but it included also the external stakeholders from society. And it attempted to do that in a way that seemed natural in relation to the management of the critical infrastructures. And in order to deploy these policies, a timeline was developed based on expert knowledge. So this is one of the many attempts to advance the understanding of resilience. Don't take this as the final word, because it was also pioneer work, but at least that gives you some idea of the many kind of approaches that need to be done. Very often, owing to situations where we are working at the border of knowledge, we let us guide through the recommendations and insights from experts that we done involved in processes like the Delphi exercise. What you could do so as to get a bit more complete understanding of that is you could look in Wikipedia, and if you put in Delphi, do you know why this is called the Delphi method? Delphi? Because there was an oracle in antique Greece, the oracle in Delphi. You ask her any question and the oracle will give you an answer, and so on. So here you have an information as to the Delphi method. As you can see, it's a structure, communication, technique, or method for forecasting based on panels of experts. And here you have a more description as to how this is done, and also procedures. This is one, it's a popular and important method that it uses in social science. And it may pay you for looking at this if you are considering doing a master thesis. Then one way of proceeding could be by using a Delphi technique, which is based then on surveys with involvement of experts. So typically what you have to do in such kind of research is first prepare the ground by looking at the state of the art, then identify issues that need to be investigated, develop a pre-proposal, locate and find experts who you think they have specialized knowledge in this area, invite them to participate. Once you have them and they said yes, I participate, then you start the Delphi exercise. People are very busy, so this survey shouldn't take too much time, so they must be carefully prepared in order to do that. We are doing now currently in our European project a Delphi exercise. Maybe I can show you a bit information as to how such a Delphi looks. Yes, if you are interested, just so that you have an idea as to the questionnaire. Okay, as you can see, I have a lot of emails. Well, I don't find the actual online, but I have that in Word here. So you start typically by describing what it is. So you see, this survey requests your expert opinion, and so on and so on. Some explanation about the project, some explanation as to how the Delphi will be. So typically, a Delphi process includes several rounds. Sometimes two, sometimes three. So a first questionnaire, which is then analyzed and processed to a second round and so on. And then after some iterations, you have achieved and have the information that you need, gathered from experts. Okay. And then you start with information of the suppliers, and expertise and so on. And you give them some item and ask them for your opinion, comments, improvements, whatever. Then you proceed to the next issue and put then a number of questions and so on, and so on and so on and so on. And it could be like you put some statements and you ask them whether they are strongly disagree, up to strongly agree and so on. So it is like a survey in some sense. The difference is that you are not so much interested in the, say, gathering some data. You are rather using experts to provide you guidance on issues, just to identify best whatever. So you give them some preliminary results and use their expertise so as to make advances and so on. Any questions as to this issue of Delphi process? So this is, in social science, a very important method where you can utilize knowledge from experts to help you obtain some results that will be so to speak, in accordance with experts' views. Even the experts can be wrong, so this is not substitute for going to the depths with some other methods, but often the first steps is to invoke the expertise so as to create what is the big picture today in the mind of the experts. Okay, so this is not so important. It was about the work of Lavaca. And with this, I hope that you got some ideas as to the issues of high reliability and resilience. As I said, there are a lot of projects working with this, and there is a huge amount of work needed in order to create resilient organizations. But on the other hand, there is a great interest, and there is a great effort being made in achieving resilience. So that's something that you will hear a lot of in more and more in the future. So we are coming now closer and closer to the end of the course. Among the topics that are left now are about malicious insiders and security and safety in integrated operations, which is a process which is still going on. Perhaps I take first the security and safety in integrated operations, since this is very much related to issues of importance to Norway. So here we look at a process that has been going on for many years and will go on for many years. Perhaps it will never end. So as you certainly know, when the oil and gas was discovered in Norwegian offshore, that was in the 60s, it took some years until the first oil was produced and the first gas was extracted. And originally, the way this was done was in isolated platforms, far from land, and you had a lot of staff and equipment there, and it was early recognized that it was risky operations. There are many things that can go wrong. As a whole, it has been performing very well, but partly to reduce risks and partly to extend and improve the benefits. In the 90s, so 25 years ago, they started planning for connecting all the resources in offshore in digital networks in order to conduct remote operations. Originally, this was called e-operations, but then it was understood that the fact of connecting everything digitally not only allowed to do the operations remotely in forms of e-operations from control centers onshore, but you could also use the same structures for many other things, including planning for capacity for exploiting distribution and so on, involving more and more companies, distributing work and so on and so on. So some 10 years ago, or perhaps 12 years ago, the term e-operation was replaced by integrated operations. And this process is so complex that it took more than 10 years until the first pilot were established, and it's still going on in terms of new technology, new possibilities, and advances and so on. So an issue was, what are the risks? If you transfer operations to do remotely using digital resources, then you can save a lot of money. This has created benefits for Norway in the order of, I think, 250 billions, so that's the added gain from doing this. It has extended the lifetime of the oil and gas deposits and reduced costs. But then, and it has also reduced risks. The less people you have in platforms, the less problems that you will have with accidents, and accidents can be many things. There has been fire in one of the wells, but that's a long time ago. There was also a structure that capsized, and hundreds of people died, and so on. Then occasionally we have had transport accidents, that the recent helicopter accidents. And of course, if you have, instead of some 20, 30 people in the platforms, you have several hundreds of them, then the risk increases, because the more you fly, the more things that can happen. But basically, the project in which I participated, in fact, I directed that, and we had to cooperate, Statoil, and we cooperated with, actually with, at that time it was called Norsk Hydro, but then it merged with Statoil in terms of oil and gas. And we cooperated with it oil Landsforening oil, exactly, something like I forgot the name. ULF, I think it was abbreviated. And our idea was to look at what. Sorry, this loudspeaker is failing. I don't know what is wrong. So, what kind of information security risks that are introduced, and what consequences has this for safety? So, what we did was to create a system dynamics model based on working together with experts in group model building exercises. I gave you a survey of group model building some time ago. First, as I said, the motivation of moving from offshore operations to integrated operations conducted from inshore is reducing of the staff. I said here it says 40%, I think even more. Big savings, extending the life of the fields by 5 or more years. And then expected net present value, then it was even bigger than I said. I said 250, but perhaps it was 250, 240 billion euros or dollars. So as you can see, even in terms of Norwegian crowns, it was estimated value, net present value, more than 4,000 billions, milliarder, the savings. So that's quite increasing. So we wanted to understand what kind of risks they were involved in this transition. And for this, we work with system dynamics and group model building. In group model building, so we had several meetings with experts from Norsk Hydro, which during our project was merged with Statoil. The issue with this group on buildings is to involve the experts in different exercises so as to elicit knowledge, so as to be able to conduct as develop a system dynamic model. So we had two workshops with experts, and it was a mixed team. We were experts in oil production, information security, risk mitigation. We did that in 2005. And then we created a model where we the key issue was that by transitioning from traditional operations to integrated operations, you needed also a transition of knowledge, because that's novel ways of doing. And there would be a gap in knowledge between the knowledge that we had developed and the required knowledge. And if there is a knowledge gap, there is a risk. And if there is a risk combined with threats, there can be damage to occur. So that was the initial idea of the system dynamic model that we developed with experts. But then, by having teams of experts in control centers, we called them at that time collaborative workspaces, then that could reduce the gaps, both in terms of technology, work processing capacity, in terms of sorry, I have problems with my throat. I lose my voice. And knowledge and capacity. Then we created a number of, together with the experts, a number of feedback loops that according to the information that we got from the experts, we on play. So for instance, there was some resistance among the staff to change. Obviously, if you are reducing the staff, and that was very lucrative, very well paid in that, then you could expect a lot of concerns among the people who were losing the job. But some of these concerns could be quite real. These concerns could reinforce themselves so as to make it difficult to integrate knowledge because of the resistance to change. So that's what this feedback loop explained. Or other processes which are not depicted here. But after the first workshop, we had a number of insights, and one of the main insights was, if you are transferring from traditional operations to new operations, then there are two kinds of gaps that are created. One is that you need to develop new processes, and while you are developing them and they are not finalized, you have a gap between the required processes and the needed processes, and you still need to operate. But also you have a gap in that new equipment and new processes require new knowledge. And the risk is associated very much with these gaps. Then, as to green risk that is there, you have a double-edged sword, because how much risk you see depends also on how much you invest in detection of risk. If you invest too little, then you don't see some of the risk. But on the other hand, if you overinvest, you may perceive risks that are not there and create resistance to the transition. But if you underinvest, you will not have the same opportunities to manage control. So we provided a number of recommendations based on the insights on the right level of investment in risk. Then we created simulation models, and as you can see with these simulation models, we could show how over time, this is months, how the gaps in knowledge and work processes develop over time. Since processes were implemented stepwise, so they had identified something like 20 different processes that needed to be transferred from traditional operations to integrated operations. Yes? Yes, yes, you are right. There is something like this because in the archetype that we had, for instance, for the core, then if to take too big steps, then you are creating risk. So there is some similarity to this. You have a good memory as to that. So the audience may remember that we had an archetype, distance to the core, and it was about transferring moving from some way of operating the company to new areas and so on. So that's similar. So based on these simulations, we were able to quantify risk and provide recommendations. In the end, the system dynamic model included also learning from incidents and so on. The details here are not so important because in order to understand the details, you will have to know the problem rather in detail. Rather, what I wanted to provide you is some insight as to how, again, simulation models of security risks. In this case, it's basically also critical infrastructure. It's the infrastructure of the important infrastructure of oil and gas supply. So all these can be used to ascertain risks and provide strategies for risk mitigation and continuous improvement. Fortunately, it has turned out that the offshore business has been very well managed, so not many problems have arisen. One of the things that we discovered, nevertheless, in which is to me a bit worrying, is that they have a mixture of very different software solutions and networks, because procedures that were developed early in the 70s and 80s using all kind of programming languages like COBOL and Fortran, they can no longer be properly maintained. Nobody today programs in COBOL and Fortran. So you have a number of software packages working together with modern software packages and networks. And they are, sorry, my throat is not working properly. Fisherman's friend may help. So there's a mixture of technologies and solutions there that is quite unstable. And one of the worrying things that we learned was that patches and vulnerabilities are discovered and patches need to be applied, then they have to stop production in order to apply the patch. And of course you don't do that every day or so, because it's very costly to stop production. So they have some time slot in the year when the patches will be established. So that means, in principle, the system is vulnerable to attacks until these patches are established. So they have a system of many firewalls to protect the most critical parts. But it is a principle of security by obscurity. That's number one, which is not very good. The other thing is that they have to determine that the patch is compatible with the old software, so the conductors. And it turns out that sometimes it has consequences for the old software that cannot be changed. So in the end, they don't apply the patch. So there are some vulnerabilities in the system that could be patched but are not patched because of the complexity of the system and because it's based on old structures. So cross fingers and hope that this imperfect security is not penetrated sometime by malicious insiders. They could do a lot of work. So far that, and I think I will spend very briefly the last minutes in the last topic, and then in the last hour you can look at the examination project, either the current or the old one, which I posted. So the threat from malicious insiders, so insider attacks have to do with people that you trust that they are in the organization who misbehave. And this is a serious problem because insiders can do a lot of harm, including harm to reputation. And it's very difficult to predict or protect against insider attacks. Here in this light, the most important thing is that there is evidence that the most damaging and most successful attack on organizations come from the insides. I don't think that the picture has changed very much. There are less attacks from insiders, but they can be very, very damaging. The attacks from insiders, they can be also that insiders misbehave and conduct risks. So some years ago, a bank, a big international bank, went bankrupt because one of the insiders was doing a lot of transaction that was not authorized, and a lot of money was lost, and so on. So because of this, we need to understand what can lead to insiders, people who are employed in the organization, that they misbehave. And among the factors of risk that have been identified is that when people are very good, very competent, and so on, very often they are allowed much more freedom to do things, or they are very good at getting the tools to have much more liberties and so on. The other thing is it's difficult to detect when something is out of control, so we don't have indicators for easily observe what is going wrong. But then very often in organizations, they misbehave in terms of security. They don't have good security policies. They don't implement them, including the question that employees in sensitive operations could be dangerous if they are not pre-hired, or you are not monitors and so on. But then we have a number of problems also related to how much you trust the employees. In Norway, we have a culture of trust, and normally it goes okay. But on the other hand, if you are dealing with critical infrastructure, and the damage can be very, very profound, then it can be a very risky thing if you hire trust people blindly. So other things is that about culture, not educating the employees about them, that performance is needs to be a follow best practice. Again, in terms of insider, it's not only handling criminally, but it is also about misbehaving. For instance, in the case of Chernobyl, in a sense, they were insiders who caused the problem because they didn't follow the procedures. And that's not because they wanted to create harm. It was simply because they were nonchalant and its own. There is a model which is very simple, but gives you some idea as to the framework. It's known as the capability, motive, opportunity model. So in order for an insider to create harm, the insider needs to have capability to commit the attack, a motive, and an opportunity to do so. Now we are thinking of attacks, not only of misbehaving. It was research has shown that often insider attacks are preceded by misbehaving. Very often, the people who conduct insider attacks, they are people who want revenge or whatever, and they signal this by their behavior. So these precursors can be used to as key indicators. Then there are proposals, but they haven't been realized yet, about detection systems that could be implemented. You have here an overview of them. There are also others that recommend looking for indicators as to misbehavior, so-called meaningful errors, preparatory behavior, and so on. But this is still very much a proposal. Then there was a study where I collaborated. In fact, I was involved in developing a system dynamics model for that at the CERT Coordination Center at Pittsburgh. If you look at the web pages, you will see, in addition to these studies, banking, critical infrastructure, and so on, you have more studies. And there is a book which gives us credit for the work that we did, which is the CERT Guide to Insider Threats that appeared a couple of years ago. And then there is a number of findings. I don't think they are too important. You can read about that. But I could recommend you that you look at the CERT Coordination Center if you are interested in insiders. And there you see, CERT Guide to Insider Threats, named to be Cybersecurity Canon, and so on and so on. I know the authors. So Andrew, this man, is a good friend of mine, Andrew Moore. So, and I guess if you look here at my name, then probably you still find well, there are many Gonzales there, but probably you will see. There you see me. Da, da, da. So that.